abundance falls uselessly into the past. That is, it falls into imminence. This is the lot assigned to women in patriarchy. But this is in no way a vocation, any more than slavery is the slave's vocation. The development of this mythology is all too clear in Auguste Comte. To identify woman with altruism is to guarantee man absolute rights to her devotion. It is to impose on women a categorical must-be. The myth must not be confused with the grasp of a signification. Signification is immanent in the object. It is revealed to consciousness in a living experience, whereas the myth is a transcendent idea that escapes any act of consciousness. When Michel Leiris in L'Âge d'Homme, Manhood, describes his vision of female organs, he provides significations and does not develop a myth. Wonder at the feminine body and disgust for menstrual blood are apprehensions of a concrete reality. There is nothing mythical in the experience of discovering the voluptuous qualities of feminine flesh, and expressing these qualities by comparisons to flowers or pebbles does not turn them into myth. But to say that woman is flesh, to say that flesh is night and death, or that she is the splendor of the cosmos, is to leave terrestrial truth behind and spin off into an empty sky. After all, man is also flesh for woman, and woman is other than a carnal object. And for each person and in each experience the flesh is, takes on singular significations. It is likewise perfectly true that woman, like man, is a being rooted in nature. She is more enslaved to the species than the male is. Her animality is more manifest. But in her, as in him, the given is taken on by existence. She also belongs to the human realm. Assimilating her with nature is simply a prejudice. Few myths have been more advantageous to the ruling master caste than this one. It justifies all its privileges and even authorizes taking advantage of them. Men do not have to care about alleviating the suffering and burdens that are physiologically women's lot, since they are intended by nature. They take this as a pretext to increase the misery of the woman's condition, for example, by denying woman the right to sexual pleasure, or making her work like a beast of burden. Note, refer to Balzac, Physiology of Marriage. Do not trouble yourself in any way about her murmurings, her cries, her pains. Nature has made her for your use, made her to bear all, the children, the worries, the blows, and the sorrows of man. But do not accuse us of harshness. In the codes of all the so-called civilized nations, man has written the laws which rule the destiny of woman beneath this blood inscription. Vae victis. Woe to the vanquished. Of all these myths, none is more anchored in masculine hearts than the feminine mystery. It has numerous advantages, and first it allows an easy explanation for anything that is inexplicable. The man who does not understand a woman is happy to replace his subjective deficiency with an objective resistance. Instead of admitting his ignorance, he recognizes the presence of a mystery exterior to himself. Here is an excuse that flatters his laziness and vanity at the same time. An infatuated heart thus avoids many disappointments. If the loved one's behavior is capricious, her remarks stupid, the mystery serves as an excuse. And thanks to the mystery, this negative relation that seemed to Kierkegaard infinitely preferable to positive possession is perpetuated. Faced with a living enigma, man remains alone, alone with his dreams, hopes, fears, love, vanity. This subjective game that can range from vice to mystical ecstasy is for many a more attractive experience than an authentic relation with a human being. Upon what bases does such a profitable illusion rest? Surely, in a way, woman is mysterious, mysterious like everyone. According to Maeterlinck, each one is subject only for himself. Each one can grasp only his own self in his immanence. From this point of view, the other is always a mystery. In men's view, the opacity of the for itself is more flagrant in the feminine other. They are unable to penetrate her unique experience by any effect of sympathy. They are condemned to ignorance about the quality of woman's sexual pleasure, the discomforts of menstruation, and the pains of childbirth. The truth is that mystery is reciprocal. As another, and as a masculine other, there is also a presence closed on itself and impenetrable to woman in the heart of every man. She is without knowledge of male eroticism. But according to a universal rule already mentioned, the categories in which men think the world are constituted from their point of view as absolutes, they fail to understand reciprocity here as everywhere. As she is mystery for man, woman is regarded as mystery in herself. It is true that her situation especially disposes her to be seen in this image. Her physiological destiny is very complex. She herself endures it as a foreign story. Her body is not for her a clear expression of herself. She feels alienated from it. The link that for every individual joins physiological to psychic life. In other words, the relation between the facticity of an individual and the freedom that assumes it is the most difficult enigma brought about by the human condition. For woman, this enigma is posed in the most disturbing way. But what is called mystery is not the subjective solitude of consciousness or the secret of organic life. The word's true meaning is found at the level of communication. It cannot be reduced to pure silence, to obscurity, to absence. It implies an emerging presence that fails to appear. To say that woman is mystery is to say not that she is silent, but that her language is not heard. She is there, but hidden beneath veils. She exists beyond these uncertain appearances. Who is she? An angel? A demon? An inspiration? An actress? One supposes that either there are answers impossible to uncover, or none is adequate because a fundamental ambiguity affects the feminine being. In her heart, she is indefinable for herself, a sphinx. The fact is, deciding who she is would be quite awkward for her. The question has no answer. But it is not that the hidden truth is too fluctuating to be circumscribed. In this area, there is no truth. An existent is nothing other than what he does. The possible does not exceed the real. Essence does not precede existence. In his pure subjectivity, the human being is nothing. He is measured by his acts. It can be said that a peasant woman is a good or bad worker, that an actress has or does not have talent, but if a woman is considered in her imminent presence, absolutely nothing can be said about that. She is outside of the realm of qualification. Now, in amorous or conjugal relations, and in all relations where woman is the vassal, the other, she is grasped in her imminence. It is striking that the woman friend, colleague, or associate is without mystery. On the other hand, if the vassal is male, and if, in front of an older and richer man or woman, a young man, for example, appears as the inessential object, he also is surrounded in mystery. And this uncovers for us an infrastructure of feminine mystery that is economic. A sentiment cannot be something either. In the domain of feeling, what is real is indistinguishable from what is imaginary, writes Gide. And it is sufficient to imagine one loves in order to love. So it is sufficient to say to oneself that when one loves, one imagines one loves in order to love a little less. There is no discriminating between the imaginary and the real except through behavior. As man holds a privileged place in this world, he is the one who is able actively to display his love. Very often he keeps the woman, or at least he helps her out. In marrying her, he gives her social status. He gives her gifts. His economic and social independence permits his endeavors and innovations. Separated from Madame de Villeparisis, Monsieur de Norpois takes 24-hour trips to be with her. Very often he is busy, and she is idle. He gives her the time he spends with her. She takes it. With pleasure, passion, or simply for entertainment. Does she accept these benefits out of love or out of one interest? Does she love husband or marriage? Of course, even the proof man gives is ambiguous. Is such a gift given out of love or pity? But while normally woman finds numerous advantages in commerce with man, commerce with woman is profitable to man only in as much as he loves her. Thus, the degree of his attachment to her can be roughly estimated by his general attitude, while woman barely has the means to sound out her own heart. According to her moods, she will take different points of view about her own feelings, and as long as she submits to them passively, no interpretation will be truer than another. In the very rare cases where it is she who holds the economic and social privileges, the mystery is reversed. This proves that it is not linked to this sex rather than to the other, but to a situation. For many women, the roads to transcendence are blocked. Because they do nothing, they do not make themselves be anything. They wonder indefinitely what they could have become, which leads them to wonder what they are. It is a useless questioning. If man fails to find that secret essence, it is simply because it does not exist. Kept at the margins of the world, woman cannot be defined objectively through this world, and her mystery conceals nothing but emptiness. Furthermore, like all oppressed people, woman deliberately dissimulates her objective image. Slave, servant, indigent, all those who depend upon a master's whims have learned to present him with an immutable smile or an enigmatic impassivity. They carefully hide their real sentiments and behavior. Woman is also taught from adolescence to lie to men, to outsmart, to sidestep them. She approaches them with artificial expressions. She is prudent, hypocritical, play-acting. But feminine mystery, as recognized by mythical thinking, is a more profound reality. In fact, it is immediately implied in the mythology of the absolute other. If one grants that the inessential consciousness is also a transparent subjectivity, capable of carrying out the cogito, one grants that it is truly sovereign and reverts to the essential. For all reciprocity to seem impossible, it is necessary that the other be another for itself, that its very subjectivity be affected by alterity. This consciousness, which would be alienated as consciousness, in its pure immanent presence, would obviously be a mystery. It would be a mystery in itself because it would be it for itself. It would be absolute mystery. It is thus that, beyond the secrecy their dissimulation creates, there is a mystery of the black, of the yellow, insofar as they are considered absolutely as the inessential other. It must be noted that the American citizen who deeply confounds the average European is nonetheless not considered mysterious. One more modestly claims not to understand him. Likewise, woman does not always understand man, but there is no masculine mystery. The fact is that rich America and the male are on the side of the master, and mystery belongs to the slave. Of course, one can only dream about the positive reality of the mystery in the twilight of bad faith. Like certain marginal hallucinations, it dissolves once one tries to pin it down. Literature always fails to depict mysterious women. They can only appear at the beginning of a novel as strange and enigmatic, but unless the story remains unfinished, they give up their secret in the end and become consistent and translucent characters. The heroes in Peter Cheney's books, for example, never cease to be amazed by women's unpredictable caprices. One can never guess how they will behave. They confound all calculations. In truth, as soon as the workings of their actions are exposed to the reader, they are seen as very simple mechanisms. This one is a spy, or that one a thief. However clever the intrigue, there is always a key, and it could not be otherwise, even if the author had all the talent, all the imagination possible. Mystery is never more than a mirage. It vanishes as soon as one tries to approach it. Thus we see that myths are explained in large part by the use man makes of them. The myth of the woman is a luxury. It can appear only if man escapes the imperious influence of his needs. The more relations are lived concretely, the less idealized they are. The fellah in ancient Egypt, the Bedouin peasant, the medieval artisan, and the worker of today, in their work needs and their poverty, have relations with the particular woman who is their companion that are too basic for them to embellish her with an auspicious or fatal aura. Eras and social classes that had the leisure to daydream were the ones who created the black and white statues of femininity. But luxury also has its usefulness. These dreams were imperiously guided by interest. Yes, most myths have their roots in man's spontaneous attitude to his own existence and the world that invests it, but the move to surpass experience toward the transcendent idea was deliberately affected by patriarchal society for the end of self-justification. Through myths, this society imposed its laws and customs on individuals in an imagistic and sensible way. It is in a mythical form that the group imperative insinuated itself into each consciousness. By way of religions, traditions, language, tales, songs, and film, myths penetrate even into the existence of those most harshly subjected to material realities. Everyone can draw on myth to sublimate his own modest experiences. Betrayed by a woman he loves, one man calls her a slut. Another is obsessed by his own virile impotence. This woman is a praying mantis. Yet another takes pleasure in his wife's company. Here we have harmony, repose, Mother Earth. The taste for eternity at bargain prices and for a handy, pocket-sized absolute, seen in most men, is satisfied by myths. The least emotion, a small disagreement, become the reflection of a timeless idea. This illusion comfortably flatters one's vanity. The myth is one of those traps of false objectivity into which the spirit of seriousness falls headlong. It is once again a matter of replacing lived experience and the free judgments of experience it requires by a static idol. The myth of woman substitutes for an authentic relationship with an autonomous existent the immobile contemplation of a mirage. Mirage, mirage, kill them since we cannot seize them, or else reassure them, instruct them, help them give up their taste for jewelry, make them real equal companions, our intimate friends, associates in the here and now, dress them differently, cut their hair, tell them everything, cried Laforgue. Man would have nothing to lose, quite the contrary, if he stopped disguising woman as a symbol. Dreams, when collective and controlled, clichés, are so poor and monotonous compared to living reality. For the real dreamer, for the poet, living reality is a far more generous resource than a worn-out fantasy. The times when women were the most sincerely cherished were not courtly feudal ones, nor the gallant 19th century. They were the times, the 18th century, for example, when men regarded women as their peers. This is when women looked truly romantic. Only read Les Liaisons Dangereuses, Dangerous Liaisons, Le Rouge et le Noir, The Red and the Black, or A Farewell to Arms to realize this. Laclos heroines like Stendhal's and Hemingway's are without mystery, and they are no less engaging for it. To recognize a human being in a woman is not to impoverish man's experience. That experience would lose none of its diversity, its richness, or its intensity if it was taken on in its intersubjectivity. To reject myths is not to destroy all dramatic relations between the sexes. It is not to deny the significations authentically revealed to man through feminine reality. It is not to eliminate poetry, love, adventure, happiness, and dreams. It is only to ask that behavior, feelings, and passion be grounded in truth. Note, Laforgue goes on to say about woman, as she has been left in slavery, idleness, without arms other than her sex, she has overdeveloped it and has become the feminine. We have permitted her to overdevelop. She is on the earth for us. Well, that is all wrong. We have played doll with the woman until now. This has gone on too long. Woman is lost. Where are the women? Today's women are not women. We have seen what these mysterious slogans mean. In the eyes of men, and of the legions of women who see through these eyes, it is not enough to have a woman's body or to take on the female function as lover and mother to be a real woman. It is possible for the subject to claim autonomy through sexuality and maternity. The real woman is one who accepts herself as other. The duplicitous attitude of men today creates a painful split for women. They accept, for the most part, that woman be a peer, an equal, and yet they continue to oblige her to remain the inessential. For her, these two destinies are not reconcilable. She hesitates between them without being exactly suited to either, and that is the source of her lack of balance. For man, there is no hiatus between public and private life. The more he asserts his grasp on the world through action and work, the more virile he looks. Human and vital characteristics are merged in him, but women's own successes are in contradiction with her femininity, since the real woman is required to make herself object, to be the other. It is very possible that on this point, even men's sensibility and sexuality are changing. A new aesthetic has already been born. Although the fashion for flat chests and narrow hips, the boyish woman, only lasted a short while, the opulent ideal of past centuries has nevertheless not returned. The feminine body is expected to be flesh, but discreetly so. It must be slim and not burdened with fat, toned, supple, robust. It has to suggest transcendence. It is preferred tanned, having been bared to a universal sun like a worker's torso, not white like a hothouse plant. Woman's clothes, in becoming more practical, have not made her look asexual. On the contrary, short skirts have shown off her legs and thighs more than before. There is no reason for work to deprive her of her erotic appeal. To see woman as both a social person and carnal prey can be disturbing. In a recent series of drawings by Painet, there is a young fiancé deserting his fiancé because he was seduced by the pretty mayoress about to celebrate the marriage. Note, November 1948. That a woman could hold a man's office and still be desirable has long been a subject of more or less dirty jokes. Little by little, scandal and irony have lost their bite, and a new form of eroticism seems to be coming about. Perhaps it will produce new myths. What is certain is that today it is very difficult for women to assume both their status of autonomous individual and their feminine destiny. Here is the source of the awkwardness and discomfort that sometimes leads them to be considered a lost sex. And without doubt, it is more comfortable to endure blind bondage than to work for one's liberation. The dead, too, are better suited to the earth than the living. In any case, turning back is no more possible than desirable. What must be hoped is that men will assume, without reserve, the situation being created. Only then can women experience it without being torn. Then will Laforgue's wish be fulfilled. O young women, when will you be our brothers, our closest brothers, without ulterior motives of exploitation? When will we give to each other a true handshake? Then, Melusina, no longer under the burden of the fate unleashed on her by man alone, Melusina rescued, will find her human base. Note, Breton, Arcanum 17. Then will she fully be a human being, when woman's infinite servitude is broken, when she lives for herself and by herself, man, abominable until now, giving her her freedom. Note, Rimbaud, to Paul Demeny, May 15th, 1871. Volume 2, Lived Experience. What a curse to be a woman! And yet the very worst curse when one is a woman is, in fact, not to understand that it is one. Kierkegaard. Half victim, half accomplice, like everyone. J.P. Sartre. Introduction. Women of today are overthrowing the myth of femininity. They are beginning to affirm their independence concretely, but their success in living their human condition completely does not come easily. As they are brought up by women in the heart of a feminine world, their normal destiny is marriage, which still subordinates them to man from a practical point of view. Virile prestige is far from being eradicated. It still stands on solid economic and social bases. It is thus necessary to study woman's traditional destiny carefully. What I will try to describe is how woman is taught to assume her condition, how she experiences this, what universe she finds herself enclosed in, and what escape mechanisms are permitted her. Only then can we understand what problems women, heirs to a weighty past, striving to forge a new future, are faced with. When I use the word woman or feminine, I obviously refer to no archetype, to no immutable essence. In the present state of education and customs, must be understood to follow most of my affirmations. There is no question of expressing eternal truths here, but of describing the common ground from which all singular feminine existence stems. Part 1. Formative Years. Chapter 1. Childhood. One is not born, but rather becomes woman. No biological, psychic, or economic destiny defines the figure that the human female takes on in society. It is civilization as a whole that elaborates this intermediary product between the male and the eunuch that is called feminine. Only the mediation of another can constitute an individual as an other. Inasmuch as he exists for himself, the child would not grasp himself as sexually differentiated. For girls and boys, the body is first the radiation of a subjectivity, the instrument that brings about the comprehension of the world. They apprehend the universe through their eyes and hands, and not through their sexual parts. The drama of birth and weaning takes place in the same way for infants of both sexes. They have the same interests and pleasures. Sucking is the first source of their most pleasurable sensations. They then go through an anal phase in which they get their greatest satisfactions from excretory functions common to both. Their genital development is similar. They explore their bodies with the same curiosity and the same indifference. They derive the same uncertain pleasure from the clitoris and the penis. Insofar as their sensibility already needs an object, it turns toward the mother. It is the soft, smooth, supple feminine flesh that arouses sexual desires. And these desires are prehensile. The girl, like the boy, kisses, touches, and caresses her mother in an aggressive manner. They feel the same jealousy at the birth of a new child. They show it with the same behavior, anger, sulking, urinary problems. They have recourse to the same coquetry to gain the love of adults. Up to 12, the girl is just as sturdy as her brothers. She shows the same intellectual aptitudes. She is not barred from competing with them in any area. If well before puberty, and sometimes even starting from early childhood, she already appears sexually specified, it is not because mysterious instincts immediately destine her to passivity, coquetry, or motherhood, but because the intervention of others in the infant's life is almost originary. And her vocation is imperiously breathed into her from the first years of her life. The world is first present to the newborn only in the form of imminent sensations. He is still immersed within the whole as he was when he was living in the darkness of a womb. Whether raised on the breast or on a bottle, he is invested with the warmth of maternal flesh. Little by little, he learns to perceive objects as distinct from himself. He separates himself from them. At the same time, more or less suddenly, he is removed from the nourishing body. Sometimes he reacts to this separation with a violent fit. Note, Judith Gautier says in her accounts of her memories that she cried and wasted away so terribly when she was pulled away from her wet nurse that she had to be reunited with her. She was weaned much later. In any case, when it is consummated, around 6 months, he begins to manifest the desire to seduce others by mimicking, which then turns into a real display. Of course, this attitude is not defined by a reflective choice, but it is not necessary to think a situation to exist it. In an immediate way, the newborn lives the primeval drama of every existent, that is, the drama of one's relation to the other. Man experiences his abandonment in anguish. Fleeing his freedom and subjectivity, he would like to lose himself within the whole. Here is the origin of his cosmic and pantheistic reveries, of his desire for oblivion, sleep, ecstasy, and death. He never manages to abolish his separated self. At the least, he wishes to achieve the solidity of the in itself, to be petrified in thing. It is uniquely when he is fixed by the gaze of others that he appears to himself as a being. It is in this vein that the child's behavior has to be interpreted. In a bodily form, he discovers finitude, solitude, and abandonment in an alien world. He tries to compensate for this catastrophe by alienating his existence in an image whose reality and value will be established by others. It would seem that from the time he recognizes his reflection in a mirror, a time that coincides with weaning, he begins to affirm his identity. His self merges with this reflection in such a way that it is formed only by alienating itself. Note, this is Dr. Lacan's theory in Les complexes familiaux dans la formation de l'individu, Family Complexes in the Formation of the Individual. This fundamental fact would explain that during its development, the self keeps the ambiguous form of spectacle. Whether the mirror as such plays a more or less considerable role, what is sure is that the child, at about 6 months of age, begins to understand his parents' miming and to grasp himself under their gaze as an object. He is already an autonomous subject transcending himself toward the world, but it is only in an alienated form that he will encounter himself. When the child grows up, he fights against his original abandonment in two ways. He tries to deny the separation. He crushes himself in his mother's arms. He seeks her loving warmth. He wants her caresses. And he tries to win the approbation of others in order to justify himself. Adults are to him as gods. They have the power to confer being on him. He experiences the magic of the gaze that metamorphoses him into a delicious little angel, and now into a monster. These two modes of defense are not mutually exclusive. On the contrary, they complete and infuse each other. When seduction is successful, the feeling of justification finds physical confirmation in the kisses and caresses received. It is the same contented passivity that the child experiences in his mother's lap and under her benevolent eyes. During the first 3 or 4 years of life, there is no difference between girls' and boys' attitudes. They all try to perpetuate the happy state preceding weaning. Both boys and girls show the same behavior of seduction and display. Boys are just as desirous as their sisters to please, to be smiled at, to be admired. It is more satisfying to deny brutal separation than to overcome it, more radical to be lost in the heart of the whole than to be petrified by the consciousness of others. Carnal fusion creates a deeper alienation than any abdication under the gaze of another. Seduction and display represent a more complex and less easy stage than the simple abandonment in maternal arms. The magic of the adult gaze is capricious. The child pretends to be invisible. His parents play the game, grope around for him. They laugh, and then suddenly they declare, "You are bothersome. You are not invisible at all." A child's phrase amuses, then he repeats it. This time they shrug their shoulders. In this world as unsure and unpredictable as Kafka's universe, one stumbles at every step. Note, in L'Orange Bleu, the Blue Orange, Yasu Gauclair says about her father, "His good mood seemed as fearsome as his impatiences because nothing explained to me what could bring it about. As uncertain of the changes in his mood as I would have been of a god's whims, I revered him with anxiety. I threw out my words as I might have played heads or tails, wondering how they would be received. And further on, she tells the following anecdote. For example, one day after being scolded, I began my litany. Old table, floor brush, stove, large bowl, milk bottle, casserole, and so on. My mother heard me and burst out laughing. A few days later, I tried to use my litany to soften my grandmother, who once again had scolded me. I should have known better this time. Instead of making her laugh, I made her angrier and got an extra punishment. I told myself that adults' behavior was truly incomprehensible. That is why so many children are afraid of growing up. They desperately want their parents to continue taking them on their laps, taking them into their bed. Through physical frustration, they experience ever more cruelly that abandonment of which the human being never becomes aware without anguish. It is here that little girls first appear privileged. A second weaning, slower and less brutal than the first one, withdraws the mother's body from the child's embraces. But little by little, boys are the ones who are denied kisses and caresses. The little girl continues to be doted upon. She is allowed to hide behind her mother's skirts. Her father takes her on his knees and pats her hair. She is dressed in dresses as lovely as kisses. Her tears and whims are treated indulgently. Her hair is done carefully. Her expressions and affectations amuse. Physical contact and complacent looks protect her against the anxiety of solitude. For the little boy, on the other hand, even affectations are forbidden. His attempts at seduction, his games irritate. A man doesn't ask for kisses. A man doesn't look at himself in the mirror. A man doesn't cry, he is told. He has to be a little man. He obtains adults' approbation by freeing himself from them. He will please by not seeming to seek to please. Many boys, frightened by the harsh independence they are condemned to, thus desire to be girls. In times when they were first dressed as girls, they cried when they had to give dresses up for long pants and had to have their curls cut. Some obstinately would choose femininity, which is one of the ways of gravitating toward homosexuality. I wanted passionately to be a girl, and I was unconscious of the grandeur of being a man to the point of trying to urinate sitting down, Maurice Sachs recounts. Note, le sabbat, which is Sabbath. However, if the boy at first seems less favored than his sisters, it is because there are greater designs for him. The requirements he is subjected to immediately imply a higher estimation. In his memoirs, Maurras recounts that he was jealous of a cadet his mother and grandmother doted upon. His father took him by the hand and out of the room. "We are men. Let's leave these women," he told him. The child is persuaded that more is demanded of boys because of their superiority. The pride of his virility is breathed into him in order to encourage him in this difficult path. This abstract notion takes on a concrete form for him. It is embodied in the penis. He does not experience pride spontaneously in his little indolent sex organ, but he feels it through the attitude of those around him. Mothers and wet nurses perpetuate the tradition that assimilates phallus and maleness, whether they recognize its prestige in amorous gratitude or in submission, or that they gain revenge by seeing it in the baby in a reduced form. They treat the child's penis with a singular deference. Rabelais reports on Gargantua's wet nurse's games and words. Note, and already beginning to exercise his codpiece, which each and every day his nurses would adorn with lovely bouquets, fine ribbons, beautiful flowers, pretty tufts, and they spent their time bringing it back and forth between their hands like a cylinder of salve. Then they laughed their heads off when it raised its ears, as if they liked the game. One would call it my little spigot, another my ninepin, another my coral branch, another my stopper, my cork, my gimlet, my ramrod, my awl, my pendant. History has recorded those of Louis XIII's wet nurses. Less daring women, however, give a friendly name to the little boy's sex organ. They speak to him about it as of a little person who is both himself and other than himself. They make of it, according to the words already cited, an alter ego, usually craftier, more intelligent, and more clever than the individual. Note, cited by A. Balint, The Psychoanalysis of the Nursery. Anatomically, the penis is totally apt to play this role. Considered apart from the body, it looks like a little natural plaything, a kind of doll. The child is esteemed by esteeming his double. A father told me that one of his sons at the age of 3 was still urinating sitting down, surrounded by sisters and girl cousins. He was a shy and sad child. One day, his father took him with him to the toilet and said, "I will show you how men do it." From then on, the child, proud to be urinating standing up, scorned the girls who urinated through a hole. His scorn came originally not from the fact that they were lacking an organ, but that they had not, like him, been singled out and initiated by the father. So, far from the penis being discovered as an immediate privilege from which the boy would draw a feeling of superiority, its value seems, on the contrary, like a compensation invented by adults and fervently accepted by the child for the hardships of the last weaning. In that way, he is protected against regret that he is no longer a breastfeeding baby or a girl. From then on, he will embody his transcendence and his arrogant sovereignty in his sex. The girl's lot is very different. Mothers and wet nurses have neither reverence nor tenderness for her genital parts. They do not focus attention on this secret organ of which only the outside envelope can be seen and that cannot be taken hold of. In one sense, she does not have a sex. She does not experience this absence as a lack. Her body is evidently a plenitude for her, but she finds herself in the world differently from the boy, and a group of factors can transform this difference into inferiority in her eyes. Few questions are as much discussed by psychoanalysts as the famous female castration complex. Most accept today that penis envy manifests itself in very different ways, depending on the individual case. Note. Besides Freud's and Adler's works, there is today an abundant literature on the subject. Abraham was the first one to put forward the idea that the girl considered her sex a wound resulting from a mutilation. Karen Horney, Jones, Jeanne Lampel de Grout, H. Deutsch, and A. Balint study the question from a psychoanalytical point of view. Saussure tries to reconcile psychoanalysis with Piaget's and Luque's ideas. Refer also to Pollock, Children's Ideas on Sex Differences. First, many girls are ignorant of male anatomy until an advanced age. The child accepts naturally that there are men and women, as there are a sun and a moon. She believes in essences contained in words, and his curiosity is at first not analytical. For many others, this little piece of flesh hanging between boys' legs is insignificant or even derisory. It is a particularity like that of clothes and hairstyle. Often the female child discovers it at a younger brother's birth, and when the little girl is very young, says Helena Deutsch, she is not impressed by her younger brother's penis. She cites the example of an 18-month-old girl who remained absolutely indifferent to the discovery of the penis and did not give it any value until much later, in connection with her personal preoccupations. The penis can even be considered an anomaly. It is a growth, a vague, hanging thing like nodules, teats, and warts. It can inspire disgust. Lastly, the fact is that there are many cases of the little girl being interested in a brother's or a friend's penis. But that does not mean she experiences a specifically sexual jealousy, and even less, that she feels deeply moved by the absence of this organ. She desires to appropriate it for herself as she desires to appropriate any object, but this desire may remain superficial. It is certain that the excretory function, and particularly the urinary one, interest children passionately. Wetting the bed is often a protest against the parent's marked preference for another child. There are countries where men urinate sitting down, and there are women who urinate standing up. This is the way among many women peasants. But in contemporary Western society, custom generally has it that they squat, while the standing position is reserved to males. This is the most striking sexual difference for the little girl. To urinate, she has to squat down, remove some clothes, and above all, hide a shameful and uncomfortable servitude. Shame increases in the frequent cases in which she suffers from involuntary urinary emissions. When bursting out laughing, for example, control is worse than for boys. For them, the urinary function is like a free game with the attraction of all games in which freedom is exercised. The penis can be handled. Through it, one can act, which is one of the child's deep interests. A little girl, seeing a boy urinate, declared admiringly, "How practical!" Note, cited by A. Balint. The stream can be aimed at will, the urine directed far away. The boy draws a feeling of omnipotence from it. Freud spoke of the burning ambition of early diuretics. Steckel discussed this formula sensibly, but it is true that, as Karen Horney says, fantasies of omnipotence, especially of a sadistic character, are as a matter of fact more easily associated with the jet of urine passed by the male. Note, On the Genesis of the Castration Complex in Women, International Journal of Psychoanalysis, 1923-24. There are many such fantasies in children, and they survive in some men. Note, Montelon's The Caterpillars, June Solstice. Abraham speaks of the great pleasure women experience watering the garden with a hose. I think, in agreement with Sartre's and Bachelard's theories, Note, see Volume 1, Part 1, Chapter 2, that it is not necessarily the assimilation of the hose with the penis that is the source of pleasure. Note, it is clear, though, in some cases. Every stream of water seems like a miracle, a defiance of gravity. Directing or governing it means carrying off a little victory over natural laws. In any case, for the little boy, there is a daily amusement that is impossible for his sisters. He is also able to establish many relations with things through the urinary stream, especially in the countryside, water, earth, moss, snow. There are little girls who lie on their backs and try to practice urinating in the air, or who try to urinate standing up in order to have these experiences. According to Karen Horney, they also envy the opportunity to exhibit that the boy is granted. A sick woman suddenly exclaimed, after seeing a man urinating in the street, "If I might ask a gift of Providence, it would be to be able just for once to urinate like a man," Karen Horney reports. It seems to girls that the boy, having the right to touch his penis, can use it as a plaything, while their organs are taboo. That these factors make the possession of a male sex organ desirable for many of them is a fact confirmed by many studies and confidences gathered by psychiatrists. Havelock Ellis quotes the words of a patient he calls Xenia. "The noise of a jet of water, especially coming out of a long hose, has always been very stimulating for me, recalling the noise of the stream of urine observed in childhood in my brother and even in other people." Note, refer to Ellis, Discussion of Undinism in Studies in the Psychology of Sex, translation. Another woman, Mrs. R.S., recounts that as a child she absolutely loved holding a little friend's penis in her hands. One day she was given a hose. It seemed delicious to hold that as if I was holding a penis. She emphasized that the penis had no sexual meaning for her, she only knew its urinary usage. The most interesting case, that of Flory, is reported by Havelock Ellis and later analyzed by Steckel. Note, H. Ellis, Studies in the Psychology of Sex, Volume 13. Here is a detailed account from it. The woman concerned is very intelligent, artistic, active, biologically normal, and not homosexual. She says that the urinary function played a great role in her childhood. She played urinary games with her brothers, and they wet their hands without feeling disgust. My earliest ideas of the superiority of the male were connected with urination. I felt aggrieved with nature because I lacked so useful and ornamental an organ. No teapot without a spout felt so forlorn. It required no one to instill into me the theory of male predominance and superiority. Constant proof was before me. She took great pleasure in urinating in the country. Nothing could come up to the entrancing sound as the stream descended on crackling leaves in the depth of a wood, and she watched its absorption. Most of all, she was fascinated by the idea of doing it into water, as are many little boys. There is a quantity of childish and vulgar imagery showing little boys urinating in ponds and brooks. Flory complains that the style of her knickers prevented her from trying various desired experiments, but often during country walks she would hold back as long as she could and then suddenly relieve herself standing. I can distinctly remember the strange and delicious sensation of this forbidden delight, and also my puzzled feeling that it came standing. In her opinion, the style of children's clothing has great importance for feminine psychology in general. It was not only a source of annoyance to me that I had to unfasten my drawers and then squat down for fear of wetting them in front, but the flap at the back, which must be removed to uncover the posterior parts during the act, accounts for my early impression that in girls this function is connected with those parts. The first distinction in sex that impressed me, the one great difference in sex, was that boys urinated standing and that girls had to sit down. The fact that my earliest feelings of shyness were more associated with the back than the front may have thus originated. All these impressions were of great importance in Flory's case, because her father often whipped her until the blood came, and also a governess had once spanked her to make her urinate. She was obsessed by masochistic dreams and fancies, in which she saw herself whipped by a schoolmistress under the eyes of all and having to urinate against her will. An idea that gives one a curious sense of gratification. At the age of 15, it happened that, under urgent need, she urinated standing in a deserted street. In trying to analyze my sensations, I think the most prominent lay in the shame that came from standing, and the consequently greater distance the stream had to descend. It seemed to make the affair important and conspicuous, even though clothing hid it. In the ordinary attitude, there is a kind of privacy. As a small child, too, the stream had not far to go. But at the age of 15, I was tall, and it seemed to give one a glow of shame to think of this stream falling unchecked such a distance. I am sure that the ladies who fled in horror from the urinette at Portsmouth thought it most indecent for a woman to stand, legs apart, and to pull up her clothes and make a stream which descended unabashed all that way. Note: in an allusion to an episode she related previously, at Portsmouth, a modern urinette for ladies was opened that called for the standing position. All the clients were seen to depart hastily as soon as they entered. She renewed this experience at 20 and frequently thereafter. She felt a mixture of shame and pleasure at the idea that she might be surprised and that she would be incapable of stopping. The stream seemed to be drawn from me without my consent, and yet with even more pleasure than if I were doing it freely. This curious feeling that it is being drawn away by some unseen power which is determined that one shall do it is an entirely feminine pleasure and a subtle charm. There is a fierce charm in the torrent that binds one to its will by a mighty force. Later, Flory developed a flagellatory eroticism always combined with urinary obsessions. This case is very interesting because it throws light on several elements of the child's experience. But of course, there are particular circumstances that confer such a great importance upon them. For normally raised little girls, the boy's urinary privilege is too secondary a thing to engender a feeling of inferiority directly. Psychoanalysts following Freud, who think that the mere discovery of the penis would be sufficient to produce a trauma, seriously misunderstand the child's mentality. It is much less rational than they seem to think. It does not establish clear-cut categories and is not bothered by contradictions. When the little girl, seeing a penis, declares, "I had one too," or "I'll have one too," or even "I have one too," this is not a defense in bad faith. Presence and absence are not mutually exclusive. The child, as his drawings prove, believes much less in what he sees with his eyes than in the signifying types that he has determined once and for all. He often draws without looking, and in any case, he finds in his perceptions only what he puts there. Saussure, who emphasizes this point, quotes this very important observation of Lucase. Once a line is considered wrong, it is as if inexistent. The child literally no longer sees it, hypnotized in a way by the new line that replaces it, nor does he take into account lines that can be accidentally found on his paper. Note, Psychologie génétique et psychanalyse, genetic psychology and psychoanalysis. Revue Française de Psychanalyse, 1933. Male anatomy constitutes a strong form that is often imposed on the little girl, and literally she no longer sees her own body. Saussure brings up the example of a 4-year-old girl who, trying to urinate like a boy between the bars of a fence, said she wanted a little long thing that runs. She affirmed at the same time that she had a penis and that she did not have one, which goes along with the thinking by participation that Piaget described in children. The little girl takes it for granted that all children are born with a penis, but that the parents then cut some of them off to make girls. This idea satisfies the artificialism of the child who glorifies his parents and conceives of them as the cause of everything he possesses, says Piaget. He does not see punishment in castration right away. For it to become a frustration, the little girl has to be unhappy with her situation for some reason. As Deutsch justly points out, an exterior event like the sight of a penis could not lead to an internal development. The sight of the male organ can have a traumatic effect, she says, but only if a chain of prior experiences that would create that effect had preceded it. If the little girl feels powerless to satisfy her desires of masturbation or exhibition, if her parents repress her onanism, if she feels less loved or less valued than her brothers, then she will project her dissatisfaction onto the male organ. The little girl's discovery of the anatomical difference with the boy confirms a previously felt need. It is her rationalization, so to speak. Note, H. Deutsch, Psychology of Women. She also cites the authority of K. Abraham and J. H. W. von Oppoisen. And Adler also insisted on the fact that it is the validation by the parents and others that gives the boy prestige, and that the penis becomes the explanation and symbol in the little girl's eyes. Her brother is considered superior. He himself takes pride in his maleness, so she envies him and feels frustrated. Sometimes she resents her mother and less often her father. Either she accuses herself of being mutilated, or she consoles herself by thinking that the penis is hidden in her body and that one day it will come out. It is sure that the absence of a penis will play an important role in the little girl's destiny, even if she does not really envy those who possess one. The great privilege that the boy gets from it is that as he is bestowed with an organ that can be seen and held, he can at least partially alienate himself in it. He projects the mystery of his body and its dangers outside himself, which permits him to keep them at a distance. Of course, he feels endangered through his penis. He fears castration. But this fear is easier to dominate than the pervasive overall fear the girl feels concerning her insides, a fear that will often be perpetuated throughout her whole life as a woman. She has a deep concern about everything happening inside her. From the start, she is far more opaque to herself and more profoundly inhabited by the worrying mystery of life than the male. Because he recognizes himself in an alter ego, the little boy can boldly assume his subjectivity. The very object in which he alienates himself becomes a symbol of autonomy, transcendence, and power. He measures the size of his penis. He compares his urinary stream with that of his friends. Later, erection and ejaculation will be sources of satisfaction and challenge. But a little girl cannot incarnate herself in any part of her own body. As compensation, and to fill the role of alter ego for her, she is handed a foreign object, a doll. Note that the bandage wrapped on an injured finger is also called a poupée, doll in French. A finger, dressed and separated from the others, is looked on with amusement and a kind of pride with which the child initiates the process of its alienation. But it is a figurine with a human face, or a corn husk, or even a piece of wood that will most satisfyingly replace this double, this natural toy, this penis. The great difference is that, on the one hand, the doll represents the whole body, and on the other hand, it is a passive thing. As such, the little girl will be encouraged to alienate herself in her person as a whole and to consider it an inert given. While the boy seeks himself in his penis as an autonomous object, the little girl pampers her doll and dresses her as she dreams of being dressed and pampered. Inversely, she thinks of herself as a marvelous doll. Note, the analogy between the woman and the doll remains until the adult age. In French, a woman is vulgarly called a doll. In English, a dressed-up woman is said to be dolled up. Through compliments and admonishments, through images and words, she discovers the meaning of the words pretty and ugly. She soon knows that to please, she has to be pretty as a picture. She tries to resemble an image. She disguises herself. She looks at herself in the mirror. She compares herself to princesses and fairies from tales. Marie Bashkirtseff gives a striking example of this infantile coquetry. It is certainly not by chance that, weaned late, she was 3 1/2, she fervently felt the need at the age of 4 or 5 to be admired and to exist for others. The shock must have been violent in a more mature child, and she had to struggle even harder to overcome the inflicted separation. At 5 years old, she writes in her diary, I would dress in mummy's lace with flowers in my hair, and I would go and dance in the living room. I was Petipa, the great dancer, and the whole house was there to look at me. Note, Bashkirtseff, I am the most interesting book of all, translation. This narcissism appears so precociously for the little girl and will play so fundamental a part in her life that it is readily considered as emanating from a mysterious feminine instinct. But we have just heard that in reality it is not an anatomical destiny that dictates her attitude. The difference that distinguishes her from boys is a fact that she could assume in many ways. Having a penis is certainly a privilege, but one whose value naturally diminishes when the child loses interest in his excretory functions and becomes socialized. If he retains interest in it past the age of 8 or 9 years, it is because the penis has become the symbol of a socially valorized virility. The fact is that the influence of education and society is enormous here. All children try to compensate for the separation of weaning by seductive and attention-seeking behavior. The boy is forced to go beyond this stage. He is saved from his narcissism by turning his attention to his penis, whereas the girl is reinforced in this tendency to make herself object, which is common to all children. The doll helps her, but it does not have a determining role. The boy can also treasure a teddy bear or a rag doll on whom he can project himself. It is in their life's overall form that each factor, penis, doll, takes on its importance. Thus, the passivity that essentially characterizes the feminine woman is a trait that develops in her from her earliest years. But it is false to claim that therein lies a biological given. In fact, It is a destiny imposed on her by her teachers and by society. The great advantage for the boy is that his way of existing for others leads him to posit himself for himself. He carries out the apprenticeship of his existence as free movement toward the world. He rivals other boys in toughness and independence. He looks down on girls, climbing trees, fighting with his companions, confronting them in violent games. He grasps his body as a means to dominate nature and as a fighting tool. He is proud of his muscles, as he is of his sex organ. Through games, sports, fights, challenges, and exploits, he finds a balanced use of his strength. At the same time, he learns the severe lessons of violence. He learns to take blows, to deride pain, to hold back tears from the earliest age. He undertakes, he invents, he dares. Granted, he also experiences himself as if for others. He tests his own virility, and consequently, trouble ensues with adults and friends. But what is very important is that there is no fundamental opposition between this objective figure that is his and his will for self-affirmation in concrete projects. It is by doing that he makes himself be in one single movement. On the contrary, for the woman, there is, from the start, a conflict between her autonomous existence and her being other. She is taught that to please, she must try to please, must make herself object. She must therefore renounce her autonomy. She is treated like a living doll, and freedom is denied her. Thus a vicious circle is closed, for the less she exercises her freedom to understand, grasp, and discover the world around her, the less she will find its resources, and the less she will dare to affirm herself as subject. If she were encouraged, she could show the same vibrant exuberance, the same curiosity, the same spirit of initiative, and the same intrepidness as the boy. Sometimes this does happen when she is given a male upbringing. She is thus spared many problems. Note, at least in her early childhood. In today's society, adolescent conflicts could, on the contrary, be exacerbated.